Hello, everybody. Welcome to the next episode of Open Science Radio. We have number 38. And as you can hear, we record this today in English because we have an English-speaking guest. And we are very glad to welcome Greg Wilson from Software Carpentry here. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. I'm fine. And sure, besides me, also Matthias is here. Hi, Matthias.
Hello.
Okay, so Greg, thanks for being here. We really had some trouble finding a spot with you, which is partly our fault. And well, we would like to talk to you because you are very deeply involved in software carpentry. Maybe before we start with software carpentry itself, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit.
Sure. My name is Greg Wilson. I'm a Canadian. I worked for several years in the 80s and 90s in high-performance scientific computing when the first generation parallel machines were starting to spread. And after a few years of that, I came to believe that we were probably doing more harm than good. If you give the average scientist a supercomputer, it's sort of like giving the average teenager a Formula One race car. Now, there are things that you need to know before you try to parallelize your 500,000 lines of legacy Fortran. Things like, why should I break my code up into functions? And what is version control? And how do I write tests? And over again, I saw that scientists weren't being taught these skills. They were trying to run before they could crawl, much less walk. And I started complaining about this. And finally, John Reinders from the Advanced Computing Lab at Los Alamos National Laboratory in the United States said, all right, show me that you can actually make a difference. And so he arranged for Brent Gorda and I to come and start running some classes there. Brent at the time was at Lawrence Livermore. He's now with Intel. So we showed up in the summer of 1998 to run our first class. And from our point of view, it was a complete shambles. From their point of view, it was a roaring success, because we were filling in that gap between how do I write a for loop and how do I parallelize my 500,000 lines of Fortran. The class was on and off for a few years. I got involved in a startup. Brent got distracted by other things. We had a grant from the Python Software Foundation in the early 2000s to rewrite the material and make it all open access. And then I came back in 2010 after leaving the University of Toronto and started doing this as my full-time job. My goal there was, again, to help scientists with all those basic lab skills for computing that nobody else was teaching them. But there was also a growing move towards open science, towards reproducible research. And once again, I saw people who wanted to do the right thing but couldn't because they didn't have the technical skills. It's all very well to tell a scientist that she should make her data openly available, but if she doesn't understand what a primary key is or why a zip file with a couple of badly named spreadsheets uploaded to Figshare isn't really useful to other people, then the openness isn't going to happen in practice. You have to be able to do it in order for it to make a difference. So with a bunch of support from a variety of organizations, I started running workshops in several countries and then taking people who'd been through those workshops and training them as instructors. And that's when software carpentry really started to take off, when we started taking people who had gone through the class, knew the material, and wanted to pass it on to their colleagues and having them run workshops. We started to grow linearly. I wish I could say exponentially. But in fact, the growth has been pretty close to linear. Last year, we taught about 12,000 people. We ran about 300 events. And last week, we certified our 500th instructor in, last time I checked, over 30 countries. Now, in doing that, we have shaved the material down over and over again. What was a one-week workshop is now 2 days, partly because there's no point teaching for 5 straight days. By the end of the second day, everybody is tired. And what you tell them on day 3, never mind day 5, just bounces off because they're exhausted. Partly also, shaving down to 2 days has forced us to concentrate on what we think are the real core skills. What are the things that every researcher ought to know? And it turns out there isn't a single answer to that. And I worked with Brent to create Software Carpentry because we felt that the everyday needs of scientists weren't being addressed. What I learned between 2010 and 2013 or 2014, I guess, was that I had still aimed too high. If you think of scientific computer users as a pyramid, I wasn't aiming at the top, at the HPC, but I was still aiming at the next layer down, the people who are starting to think about building libraries or packages for others to use, the sort of people who are thinking about using GitHub to collaborate with colleagues at other sites. If you go down another level and look at the people who are currently analyzing data in Excel or in interactive tools like SAS and Stata, there are 10 times as many of those as there are people trying to build R packages. So in 2014, a group led by Tracy Teal spun out of Software Carpentry to create Data Carpentry. And Data Carpentry's focus is to get people who are currently doing their data analysis interactively with no real hope of reproducibility to start using tools that will at least allow reproducibility. Get them off Excel and into R. Get them to start using tools like OpenRefine, which help you clean up your data, but also keep a log of what you did so that you've got some idea of how your analyzed data set differs from the raw data that you got from, you know, the school board, the health department, your colleagues in Ecuador. Software Carpentry is now refocusing on the next level up, people who are already comfortable writing one-page scripts, but they want to start writing larger pieces of software. They need to learn how to use the Unix shell because they want to put things on a cluster. They need to learn version control so they can collaborate. And of course, they need to learn more about a programming language. But more importantly, they need to learn more about how to structure programs, how to break it up into pieces that are readable, reusable, and testable. And if they come out of the 2 days understanding that those are all the same thing, then we've accomplished our goal. The other thing I should say by way of introduction is that my personal focus has shifted over the years. 6 years ago, as I was planning to leave U of T, University of Toronto, I thought my primary focus was going to be teaching scientists how to program. And that is still the main aim of Software Carpentry, although we would now use the word researchers because we're helping people who are in, for example, digital humanities, the social sciences, and so forth. But my personal focus now is on how do we improve teaching. I don't know if either of you have ever taught at the university level, but almost without exception, somebody gets a PhD in geophysics and is then told, go and teach calculus to engineers, having had no real training in how to teach. And knowing the subject matter doesn't mean that you can actually teach it. So partly in self-defense, partly so that we could get the most out of our volunteer instructors, we began teaching better teaching methods in our instructor training course. And then we discovered that once people know that, they're more likely to start contributing to lessons in the same way that they contribute to open source projects. If you take a look at Wikipedia, you're seeing more than 1 million people collaboratively writing really readable prose about everything from DC Comics to the discovery of quantum mechanics. If you take a look at open source software, you will see thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people contributing to large and complex code bases. Nowhere have we found hundreds, much less thousands of people actually contributing to specific lessons for teaching. And once you start asking why not, it seems really odd. If you, for example, think about high school mathematics, right now here in Canada, on an average Monday in Ontario, there will be thousands of teachers all across the country who are preparing more or less the same lesson. And they're all doing their own prep, which is just as crazy as having every mechanical engineer write her own linear algebra packages. Why don't we collaborate on writing lessons the same way that we collaborate on writing Wikipedia articles? There have been several attempts to do this, and they've all failed. They've never gained critical mass. Go ahead.
It actually sounds like as if you're somehow shifting from a education in scientific software engineering or programming more towards a movement within the open educational resources?
Maybe. That's my personal shift. Software Carpentry's focus is still very much delivering the lessons to the scientists. But it's interesting that in order to do that, with the very slim resources that we have 2.5 staff to run events for 12,000 people, and then a whole bunch of volunteers. It's forced us to adopt many of the same open working practices that open source software started to adopt in the 1990s. We use GitHub to manage all of our lessons, and people send us pull requests with little changes. They spot a typo, they know how to improve an exercise, they think we should add 3 lines about some configuration issue on some version of macOS. So we get the same sort of profile of contributions that a project like Django or IPython would get. And I don't know of other educational projects that are doing that. And I think that the fact that we're treating the lessons the same way we would treat software is one of the keys to our success. And personally, I'm really interested in exploring that and seeing how far we can take it so that we can reach more scientists and continue to improve all of our lesson materials. So that's where we are today. I stepped down as executive director last September. Jonah Duckles started October 1st, and he now runs the project. My focus now is on instructor training, on how we teach people to teach this, and by extension, to teach other things as well. And as I said, it's been an interesting journey.
Hmm. Well, you said right in the beginning that you basically, over the years, stripped down the material that has been used within software carpentry workshops and events from a 5-day workshop to a now more or less 2-day workshop. Would you consider that stripping down the material also enforces somehow the need for those who participate in the workshops to do more on themselves and thereby teach themselves a bit the stuff?
I don't know. What it forces us to do is prioritize. Mm-hmm. Everybody can always think of something else to add to a course, just as everybody in government can always think of something else that we ought to spend money on. But as soon as you say, here is our budget, and if we're going to add something, we have to cut something else. Now the discussion becomes more honest. I can think of 100 things I would like to teach the average graduate student in ecology about how to use a computer effectively. But if I've only got her for 2 8-hour days, that forces me to think very clearly about which are essential and which are merely important. Hmm. So, for example, I think that version control is an absolutely core skill. Is knowing how to write a make file, it's not as important. I'm not saying it's not important, but it's not as important. What about something like regular expressions or object-oriented programming or a whole long list of other things? We don't teach data visualization in software carpentry because I don't think it's as important as the other topics we have. Data carpentry does include some material on visualization, but then they don't teach the shell because learners at their level are probably not yet needing the command line. That's probably a next step for them. And honestly, I realize that there's a limit to how much people can absorb in 2 days. But if they come out of the workshop understanding a few key ideas so that they can type a sensible question into Stack Overflow and recognize a useful answer when it comes up, so that they know where to look next and how to read a manual page, then we've done our job. Our audience is mostly graduate students, and they're very good at teaching themselves once they have some sort of a map in their head. Mm. What are the big ideas? What are the key terms? How do they relate? Once they've got that, they can learn faster than we can talk. Mm. But until they've got that, what we've seen over and over again is that sources like Stack Overflow aren't usable because you don't know what questions to ask. And everybody runs into this when they go into a new research field. You don't even know what the key, what are the key papers? What are the key ideas? There's just a certain amount you have to know before anything else makes sense. Mm. And in a sense, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the characteristics of science that even the tiniest change within a question might lead you to a totally yes. different world.
Yes.
So that's always the danger of asking or putting your interest, be as broad as it is, into questions and formulations.
Yep.
Maybe it's a good idea to go back because when you say we are teaching, maybe it's a good idea to convey the idea of who's teaching to our listeners. Because I don't know whether all of our listeners are familiar with how software carpentry works. And especially it would be interesting to, since you brought up budgetary constraints, to see what you're actually doing or how you spend your financial support from organizations, grants, in sure. order to build this this chain of workshops or this
sure.
rather this world. That would be great.
Sure. I'll answer the last one first. Mm-hmm. About three quarters of our income last year was about $220,000 US. Mm-hmm. About three quarters of that comes from partnerships with universities, labs, other organizations that want to build local capacity. For example, the University of Washington is one of our partners. They want us to help train up instructors at the university so that they can run more smaller workshops. They'd like to be able to do, you know, one workshop a month for a couple of dozen people as opposed to two a year for 40 or 50. And they would like to be able to adapt the workshops to local needs a little bit better. So they partner with us for a while. We come in, we help them with curriculum development, we help train up instructors. And yes, it means that we're essentially, you know, putting ourselves out of a job, but there are enough institutions that need this that we're not worried about that anytime soon. The other quarter of our income last year comes from the administration fee we charge when we're the ones who are arranging the workshop. A place, let's use the University of Washington again as an example. They have enough instructors now on campus that they can just send mail to their local list and say, who wants to help teach a workshop in May on such and such dates? And they can handle registration, they can find the instructors, they can do all the setup that's needed. A lot of organizations, a lot of universities don't yet have people locally, so they contact us. We then go to our pool of instructors and say, all right, who would like to go to Darmstadt? Who would like to go to Berlin in May to teach on these 2 days? They would prefer somebody with a bioinformatics background, right? So we charge a fee for that. All of that money together is what helps pay for the executive director, for myself doing instructor training, and then for half the time of the program coordinator, who's doing the nuts and bolts of making sure that, you know, people have remembered to book their plane tickets and the room has actually been reserved and all of those sorts of things. The other half of the program coordinator's time is paid for by data carpentry because she's wrangling both sets of workshops, both software carpentry and data carpentry. The instructors are, as I said, mostly people who've either been through workshops or helped at workshops. Some of them will be grad students or postdocs who've picked up these skills, either from us or on their own or some mix of the two, and want to pass them on to their colleagues. And I'll come back in a moment to talk about their reasons for doing that. Mm-hmm. We're getting a growing number of instructors, though, who are university staff, typically IT staff or people working in the libraries, who do this because their lives will be easier if their clients know these things. If you're running a cluster in a geology department, you'd really, really like all the grad students in geology to know how to write a shell script before they come and start asking you for assistance.
Mm.
All right. So we do that, and that turns out to make everybody's life better. As for why people volunteer, there's a mix of reasons. Some people do it just because it's fun. And honestly, I think that's underestimated. I'm a member of the Python Software Foundation, and I really enjoy going to Python conferences because a lot of my friends go to Python conferences. It's a community that I feel I belong to, and they're fun people, and I can talk about things that I care about, some of which are pretty esoteric, like the implementation of garbage collection on multi-threaded Python and things like that. So you know, there aren't a whole lot of people that you can sit and have a beer with and geek out about redundant cortic methods. So that's part of it. We tend to attract scientists who care about doing the computing right, and they tend to be fairly isolated in their own departments. So we're a community. Another reason people teach is, as I said, self-defense. If you're IT staff in a biology department, teaching the incoming graduate students a few basic skills just makes your life better. Right. And that's part of why Brent and I set this up in the first place. These are the things that we wished everybody had known 20-odd years ago. Another reason people teach, though, is to boost their own careers. The academic job market is pretty tight these days. If you are in a field like astronomy, there are only a handful of jobs coming up next year. And anything you can do to make yourself look more useful improves your chances of at least getting the interview. Now, hiring is always going to depend on a research fit. But if you show up at, you know, the University of Amsterdam and you run a workshop for 2 days and then say, oh, I noticed that you've got a postdoc on offer next year, or I noticed that you're hiring in my field, I promise you'll get a hearing, because you'll just have demonstrated that you're a helpful person. And I'm perfectly okay with that. Our instructors are all volunteers. They do not get paid for their time, although whoever's hosting the workshop covers their travel expenses. And if we can help their careers in exchange for them helping other scientists, then I think we're doing a good thing. Hmm.
You said you're educating the instructors, right?
Yep.
So that's basically how it works. You as a basic team are educating instructors, showing them how to teach this stuff, or at least giving them an idea how to teach, so that they actually could develop their own way or style of teaching?
Well, yes.
Based on your curriculum and all this kind of...
So it turns out that we know at least as much about education and learning as we do about public health. The difference is, whereas we act on things like the germ theory of disease and, you know, the relationship between smoking and lung cancer, a lot of what science has discovered about education over the last half century is still missing from most classrooms. So we show people that there actually is solid evidence behind certain teaching practices. There is proof that some practices work better most of the time for most people, and that we should therefore use them. Mm-hmm. There are other things that are widely talked about or widely believed for which there is absolutely no basis in evidence. And so if people are going to change something, I'm actually more comfortable with them varying the curriculum to meet local needs than varying the teaching methods, because I accept that somebody doing economics probably needs to master a slightly different set of tools than somebody doing particle physics. Perfectly comfortable with that. But in all cases, they're human beings, and so we should be interspersing regular formative assessments throughout every hour. We should be doing hands-on live coding so that we can follow the learners. We should be doing a whole bunch of things that are still largely missing from both traditional university lectures and most online courses. Most MOOCs, massive open online courses, are just bad teaching delivered at the speed of the internet. The teaching method hasn't changed in 500 years. And if your doctor was only doing things that doctors in Renaissance Italy had known about, you'd go find another doctor.
By the way, this is really something, I've mentioned this, but I was participating in such an instructor training that you gave, and this was actually really the mind-blowing part about it. So you mentioned many reasons why somebody should participate in such an instructor training, career-wise and skill-wise, but also I think my teaching really dramatically improved afterwards. You really pointed me to many, many things I was not aware of, because, somebody who's doing a PhD and so on, you're not taught to be a teacher. Yep. And the course fundamentally changed this. For example, this recommendation of the book, How Learning Works, this was really great. And I think I really want to mention anybody who thinks about joining Software Carpentry, that you will be exposed to many different ways of teaching, and also, well, think more about how to teach stuff, actually, which is your focus now, right?
Yep. Yeah, and we have people who are taking what they've learned from our instructor training and using it in other classes. Gerard Gorman's group at Imperial College, for example, has been teaching classes to geophysics students. And, you know, the content is different from what we teach, but the teaching methods are ours. And they've actually got a little paper out that shows improvement in outcomes, which is completely unsurprising. And once you start paying attention to 50 years of research by smart, hardworking people, it would be amazing if your outcomes didn't improve. But again, software carpentry's primary focus is the skills that we teach. In a sense, we've been driven to adopt better practices for the same reason that open source groups in the 1990s had to adopt better practices. They were early adopters of test-driven development, of agile methods, of continuous integration, of a whole variety of things, because they couldn't afford to be sloppy. If you have the budget of a Sun or an IBM or an Oracle, you can afford to do things badly. And I mean no offense to the programmers there, but if you're a bunch of volunteers and you're broke, you have to play smarter or you can't play at all. And you know, I find it interesting that partly because we're self-selected to be people who care about education, but partly also we have to be more effective hour by hour because we've only got 2 days of contact. And partly also, I think, we have a freedom to experiment that most university lecturers don't have. When you're teaching a class at your local university, any significant changes have to be approved by a curriculum committee. It'll take months, if not years. It has to integrate with two prerequisite courses and three dependent courses, and change is difficult. And I accept that it's going to be difficult. Because we're coming in and teaching a two-day workshop that is outside the usual curriculum, we can do pretty much whatever we want as long as it works. And that's been very liberating.
Do you have any feedback loops? I mean, how do you judge what teaching works and what not? I mean, you have a lot of theoretical resources, but how do you get this?
First thing I'll say on that is our single greatest weakness. And if I could set the clock back a few years, we should have invested more in doing systematic follow-ups, some sort of systematic assessment. I am convinced that a large part of what we teach is useless. I just don't know which part. And it's a very, very difficult question. We don't know how to measure the productivity of a scientist. We don't know how to measure the productivity of a programmer. It's not as though you can put the two together and have the unknowns cancel out. If we're trying to measure the degree to which training in software skills increases scientific productivity, we're trying to solve two unsolved problems at once. That said, there are things that we could and should be doing. We just published a study done by Beth Duckles of why people teach for us. And now that's interview-based. It's qualitative. So we're not getting pie charts and bar charts out of it, but we're getting a lot of insight into what builds our community. And I'm hoping we can go back and do similar interviews with people who went through workshops a year or two ago and ask them what's changed and then see what patterns we can see. Until we do that, there's no point trying to measure micro-level detail because we would be measuring irrelevant things. The other feedback loop that we have, though, is every 2 weeks we run a debriefing session where people who've taught in the last few weeks get together for an hour online for a moderated discussion. What worked and what didn't? What was positive? What changes would you make? What new problems arose? Which parts of the lesson seemed to flow? What needs revision? We publish the minutes from those on our blog within a couple of days of each meeting. And we then try to feed that learning back into the lessons. Last year, calendar 2015, we had over 200 people make contributions to our lessons. Most of them very small, but 200 times a 1% improvement is a significant improvement. And as I said 15 minutes ago, treating the source of the lessons the way you would treat software, treating it as something where everybody can make a small improvement with very little friction, is giving us that feedback loop. If you teach a workshop and you decide that a particular example is badly worded or one of the possible answers to a multiple choice question is ambiguous, you just fix that. And maybe that's a tenth of 1% change in the outcomes. But again, multiply that by a couple of hundred over the course of a year, and the people who are using the lessons are improving them as they go along. It still doesn't solve the problem of longer-term assessment. Data Carpentry will be hiring somebody this spring to spend a couple of years focused purely on assessment. There are people in similar roles at some of the large bioinformatics consortia, and I'm hoping that they will all be able to work together so that their data will be interoperable, so that their studies will be comparable, so that we can start to get a handle on how we should do this. What questions should we ask? Because, you know, honestly, asking people, you know, how many sequences did you align this month, and is it greater than the number of sequences you aligned last month? That's not really what we're after here.
Maybe shortly coming back to how the whole system works. So you have trainers that are educated by you and your team, basically, and you provide material for their sessions, for their teaching via GitHub. So they can do basically two things. They can contribute to your material by sending pull requests and improving the material, but they can also clone the material and change it and republish it on GitHub with their own additions. Right?
Absolutely. Yep, okay. It's all Creative Commons licensed for exactly that reason.
Okay. So what you basically are building is a chain of material that's handed down from people to people and, in the best case, is improved over time and with the addition of, for example, certain examples that people use in their own teaching.
In almost all cases, people contribute back to the central core for the same reason that they contribute back to the core of something like Django, right? What we've seen in open source software is that forks rarely survive because it takes quite a large community to keep a large project going. And it's in everybody's long-term interests to maintain the central core. You know, Linux is a good example. Python is a good example. Django, you can think of hundreds of others where in theory you could fork it, but in practice that means that you're taking on a very large maintenance overhead. And one thing that I'll tell your listeners right now, the cost of maintaining a lesson over the course of several years is several times greater than the cost of writing it in the first place, just as it is with software. Keeping lessons up to date, including all of the feedback, making sure the examples still run when, you know, macOS has just been updated again, all of this stuff takes time, and people consistently underestimate how much time. Now, as an example of where people are using this model well, Alexander Konovalev and his colleagues at St. Andrews University have just released a lesson on a symbolic algebra package that uses our templates and is being maintained on GitHub in the same way that we're maintaining our lessons. It's too specialized a topic for us to include in the core. We're never going to displace the shell or GitHub or basic Python programming with symbolic algebra. But because it's interoperable with our lessons, it's going to be much easier for people who are interested in the topic to pick up, teach, and add to. I don't know yet how many other people are going to pick up our framework and use our methods for their own lessons. I think it will take years for us to figure that out, but we're certainly trying to make that barrier as low as possible. I don't think I will ever create a lesson on XML again. I've written several over the last 20 years. They were all painful. But, you know, it just isn't important enough to me. But if you're in library science or some esoteric parts of data management in biology and astronomy, you care a lot about XML. Are there enough people in our instructor community who care about XML to create and maintain a lesson? Well, that's like asking if there's enough people in the Django community who care about integration with some particular LDAP server to build and maintain a module for that LDAP server. The answer is we've made it as easy as possible for them to do. And if they really care, then they'll do it. Right? Survival of the fittest.
And it's really interesting, by the way, to just have a look at the various lessons, I think you call it, on GitHub, and have a closer look in this, into this graphs of how much commits there have been over time, when they have done, and all this kind of. It's really, really interesting. I'm actually not sure whether there's a possibility to see all of the commits in something like a graph. So all of the commits that have been done to software carpentry lessons, that would be actually really interesting.
So if any of your listeners have a little bit of time, where a little bit means probably 5 or 10 days, the question I'd like answered is, how does the pattern of contributions to software carpentry lessons compare to, number one, the pattern of contributions to open source software projects, and number two, the pattern of contributions to Wikipedia articles? Both of those have been studied, and there's lots of data available, lots of summary statistics, lots of investigation. I don't know whether lessons are like encyclopedia articles, like code, or different from both. And that would be a really, really interesting comparison. It would need somebody who understands more statistics than I do, who's willing to go out. You know, there's messy data there, but we know where to go and find it. You know, it feels like a good little data science project. And I think the resulting paper would be widely read, because we are, I think, doing something that's genuinely new. Right. And I'd really like to know.
And do you have a gut feeling? Well, I have one.
I have several, and that's the problem. I could argue it either way. Right? I mean, both stories are plausible, right? And that's why science exists, is you've got several explanations that are coherent. So you go and you look at the data, and the data tells you if you're right or wrong. Right? So we need somebody who can go and look at the data and tell us. And the answer will probably be unclear, because that's usually what you get when you talk to a data scientist. I've got 3 or 4 minutes, and then I'm going to have to run, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, no problem. Yes, I guess we covered already a lot, but maybe we can just make the connection to NumFocus. So NumFocus is kind of a funding organization.
No.
Are you connected to this, or what,
right,
what is it precisely?
So NumFocus is a nonprofit organization registered in the state of Texas. The legal term is 501c3, because that's the section of the U.S. tax code. Setting up a nonprofit in the United States takes a fair bit of work. A lot of paper have to be filed. There's, you know, every year certain reports have to be generated. So what NumFocus does is handle all of the taxation paperwork, all of the legal paperwork for organizations like Software Carpentry, the IPython Project, a variety of others. In exchange, we pay them a small fee. They take care of the stuff that I don't want to have to go and hire a tax lawyer in the United States. I wouldn't know where to start. Right? So it's worth us to pay them a small fee for them to take care of that. And in exchange, they handle the money for us. So when an organization, for example, makes a donation to Software Carpentry, on paper, legally, they are making a donation to NumFocus, which is then dispersing the money to us. Okay. And this is just for economy of scale. The Software Freedom Conservancy does the same thing for a wide variety of open source software projects. For example, the Samba project and the Inkscape project are both too big to be run out of somebody's basement, but too small for it to be worth setting up a nonprofit with an elected board and all of the tax reporting. So the Software Freedom Conservancy serves that role of being the legal entity to shelter all of these projects. It's a very useful service.
No, makes sense. And many other projects are covered here, like Jupyter, NumPy, and so on, right?
Yep.
It's really great. All right.
And they're certainly open to taking others. If it's one or two developers, it's still probably too small. By the time you've got a couple of dozen people and, you know, six figures of income in whatever your local currency is, it's time to start thinking about who owns the trademarks. The name and logo for Software Carpentry, for example, are trademarked in the United States and Canada, I think there's a couple of others in progress. Well, they shouldn't be, those trademarks shouldn't be my property, right? Because I'm just one person. They should belong to Software Carpentry. Well, that means you need a legal entity. In steps NumFocus. So, yeah, other people who've got projects on that sort of scale, definitely worth looking at.
Okay. I think we would have some other questions, but if you need to run, I guess they are not so super
important. I've got time for one more if you want.
Okay. Why MATLAB? This was my mean one. So there's a collection. Sorry for this. I don't want to start a flame war. No. But I was always wondering, MATLAB, I know MATLAB is widely used in several parts of science. Still, I think it's kind of not aligned to the open source spirit of software carpentry. This
well,
was my
we,
only mean question.
May I ask what kind of computer you're sitting in front of right now?
I'm having a Linux computer in front of me, Ubuntu.
Okay.
Sorry for that.
Okay, I'm sitting in front of a Mac. Mm. Right. So it would be hypocritical of me to say you can only use open source software. And last time I checked, Skype, which we're using for this call, isn't open source either.
You're right. Right?
So Our goal is to teach better computing practices. If people are using closed source packages like MATLAB, then we will go and teach them that. For the same reason that when we are in Brazil, we teach in Portuguese. We go to our learners. Right? And I think that we will persuade more people to be more open by being less strident. Again, this is a personal opinion. This is not Software Carpentry's position. But I think a lot of the advocates of open science actually do their cause harm by saying, if it's not 100% open, then it's not real science. Because that means pretty much everybody who was doing science before 10 years ago, and most people doing science now, aren't real scientists. Well, you're not going to persuade people by insulting them.
Right.
Right. And there's a lot of people doing a lot of really good research work using closed source tools like MATLAB or macOS. There's a lot of people in our community, for example, who think that, you know, Windows is a toy and suitable only for business use. Well, I know a lot of mechanical engineers who are designing a lot of spacecraft using closed source CAD tools on Windows and doing things that I simply couldn't do with open source tools on Linux. It's not my place to judge. Okay? I hope that the more they learn, the more they will see the advantages of openness. Right? But I think we have to show them the light rather than beat them with a stick. That's a personal opinion.
Oh, this sounds very good indeed. All right. Thank you so much, Greg. Do you have any last words that you would like to share with us or anything?
The last thing I would say is that we would love to run more workshops in continental Europe, particularly in the East and the South. If people go to our website, there's a tiny little form you can fill in to ask us to help you set up a workshop. If your listeners would like us to come and help, please just let us know.
Great. Cool. Thank you so much for your time. And this was really, really great fun. So
okay. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
I hope the audio file worked from this end, and I will figure out how to get it to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you
very
much.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. I think this was really fast, and I think we could have go on forever. And I think it's really, really amazing how Greg Milua can focus on the teaching level on this. And as mentioned, I was in one of these instructor trainings, and I gained so much out of that. And I hope you could also listen or hear how he approaches this teaching. And this is really, really, it's interesting because it's a very scientific method, right? It's a very scientific approach of doing this by looking for feedback, looking for real data that can be used in order to improve that.
But it's actually really interesting too, because this is the section that we barely touched. So it's actually really helpful and nice to have you with your own experience as being one of those people having participated in the training sessions with Software Carpentry. So maybe you could give a short insight in how that actually went.
Yeah, sure. This was basically completely online. So I have to think a little bit back. I think we did this in So it was running for several months, and was, I think, every second week or so we had a lesson we prepared before by looking into different material or actually teaching each other. For example, you had to pick, let's say, something from the Python lessons or from the R lessons that you teach a partner, and then you actually met before online and, for example, taught Python functions to somebody. And you also recorded this. You had time restrictions. You try to focus on the minimal information that you need to transport in order to get a lesson over to somebody. And this is actually really amazing. And it's also, well, you get this immediate feedback. And this is something I was not aware of. As I said, I'm doing teaching, but I never had actually formal education. Actually, meanwhile, I have a formal education because the university is actually providing such a thing. But before this, I was not exposed to this, and it showed me actually how important this is. And building these feedback loops, talking to other teachers, oh, what did I do well? What did I do so well? And how can I improve? And this is a fundamental method. I think this is also done if you do the teaching, that you talk to the other instructors, what was good, what was bad. Actually, well, Greg mentioned this, that we have to have afterwards these kind of feedback sessions in general, what worked and what didn't work, I guess, on the general level, but also on your personal level. And I think this is very helpful to have this in place. And this is also something I got from the lessons, actually, in the structural lessons. The difference between a teacher, I think, in Finland, and Finland seems to be rather good in education, or the system seems to be rather good, and a teacher in US, and I guess same here in Germany, is the amount of, or the time another teacher is sitting in your class, watching you and giving you feedback. Mm-hmm. So you are, you get an external view on your activities, on your teaching. This is very important to improve your own skills. And this is something I definitely learned out of this. Hmm.
And after having participated, you actually started to introduce a workshop at your university, right? Based on the software carpentry.
No, actually, I did this before.
Ah, right.
But, yeah. So, no, I didn't have time so far. There are, as Greg says, you actually get from that time some emails. Okay, there's a software carpentry workshop taking place there. Who can participate? And so far, nothing matched. But Malvika Sharan, she's a PhD student I'm co-supervising, and she did this, for example, in Potsdam. And basically, if you're then... Yeah, if you have time and it fits, then you can go there and basically do the teaching. Ideally, some it should be somebody from the same field, but this is not necessarily the case. For example, this Potsdam, this was, I think, a geoinformatics-related workshop.
All right. Now I understand the system, how it actually works. I thought you were kind of, as a university or as a person from a certain university, you are asking for a workshop on a specific topic, and you're not providing the teacher, but some teacher who's familiar with the subject can actually call you or contact you and tell you, hey, listen, I could take over this workshop.
Mm-hmm. This is what Greg said, how they basically get the funding. So if a university wants to run the workshop and doesn't know any teacher, they go to software carpentry, say, okay, we would like to run this and that workshop. Can you please organize us somebody?
Yeah.
Then this is going out to the different structures, and you can volunteer to this. Sometimes it's restricted. For example, if it's in the US, sure, they won't pay you a flight from Europe there. But if it's, let's say, in Europe, then it's rather likely that you can be an instructor there.
Okay, I see. And I have a mean question for you, because you had one for Greg now. I have a mean question for you. Me being neither a scientist nor a programmer, why does Python play such an important role?
I think, I have a strong opinion, and I have often the fight. So, maybe a little bit of background. I started programming with Perl, and I liked it, and I used it until the end of my studies. And when I started my PhD, I switched to Python because I heard good things about it. Not that it was very concrete; it was just I thought about doing this. And meanwhile, I think I know why this is the case. At first, it's a very clean language. It forces you to write your stuff explicitly. Mm-hmm. And this is, in comparison, let's say, to Perl, this is definitely an advantage. You can write clean code with Perl, but in Python, you're kind of forced. You really have to violate important rules and dogma of Python in order to make it ugly, I would say. Additionally, it supports very different programming paradigms, which is good because you can, let's say, you can write completely procedural, or you can write object-oriented, or you can even do functional programming. This makes it very well powerful, and it has it gives you very different ways of dealing with things. Still, one way should still be the obvious one. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, well, you see with the rise of data science, whatever this is precisely, you see two competing things. One is R, which is rather strong because it comes from the statistical community, and you see Python. And I guess Python plays now a role because with the arrival of pandas, you have something like the data frames from R, you have clean code, you have very good visualization capabilities meanwhile. And I guess this is the reason why this is so strong and used also in software carpentry. And already since the beginning, Python was one of the languages there. I think R came actually later. Hmm. And, well, as I said, I think I once had on BioStars, which is a community, online community for bioinformatics and related things. There was once the question why you should learn Python. I still think it's, especially as a first language, it's very good because it forces you to write clean code. It is very explicit, and you don't have much hidden magic somewhere.
Mm. Okay. One thing that I would have liked to ask Greg is because he was telling that he was into science and supercomputing himself. Mm-hmm. So I assume that also software carpentry started more or less in the STEM subject, as the majority of open science movements and activities. But I'm actually interested, or I actually would be interested in his impression, or even your impression, whether there is a movement away from these STEM nerds. I think Greg used the term geeks, to more general scientists is a really, really bad term. But
I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess what you mean is that more and more people are getting their hands dirty with data. I can just say this in biology. There's still these low-throughput experiments ongoing, but more and more people dealing with high-throughput data. Today you can just push a button and you've gigabytes of data just on your hard drive, high throughput sequencing and other things, for example. And you just can't load stuff into Excel anymore, right? It's just beyond that. And this is why more and more people need these very basic skills, a little bit of shell programming or a little bit of shell, or working in the shell, a little bit of programming, a little bit of R, whatever, or a little bit of SQL. And this is exactly what's covered in software carpentry. So this is, it is definitely not, maybe I'm wrong, but I would say the main audience are not the alpha geeks because they know this anyway. It's more about the people who don't have a background in computing, still facing the problem that they need to work with, let's say, large amounts of data.
Mm.
And this is, I think, meanwhile, the main audience there. And this is covered with that.
And I mean, judging from my perspective, even the material that you can get from GitHub gives you a lot of help already, a lot of guidance already, even if you're not into science or neither into hard programming. It gives you a lot of information, and since it's all available and free, you can use it, you can have a look at it. And in connection with, for example, blog posts by trainers, by people who have participated in workshops, it actually makes often a lot of sense for just answering one or two questions that you have on a certain topic. I found, for example, the automation and make stuff by Mike Jackson pretty useful. I had a look into the databases and SQL material. So it's actually worth having a look, even if you don't participate in any specific workshop.
Yeah, this is what Greg said, right? It's really polished. It's really amazing how much people looked through this and improved it. And this was, by the way, this is also part of the instructor training, is to look through the material and improve it. So there's really so many eyes had a look at this so far, and I guess this is why it's also very good. I mean, one thing, and it didn't hooked into there, but one thing is, sometimes it might be better if there would be some domain-specific focus, and this is, I mean, you can fork it and adapt it to your needs. I guess this would be something if there's more framework that you can say, okay, for geologists, I have this and this data set, and for biologists, I have that one. But okay, this is, I guess, harder to implement. And I guess this is something where everybody can agree on, and you have some basic examples that you can work with.
Yeah, I think you can even sometimes you can it's publicly available, the information who actually forked the material, so you can have a look at what they did to the material afterwards. And as I think it's a good habit for people who use the material to actually put it in a blog post and explain for which kind of domain or context they have adapted the material. And you can actually find a lot of blog posts out there based on the story, what they have done to the material and why they have taught this in a certain way and what's the background of the workshop and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's really, really wide universe.
Yeah. Talking about the blog, this is something I also wanted to ask Greg. Maybe you can just continue. Maybe he can throw this into the commentaries later on at some point. The blog of Software Carpentry is amazingly active. This is really,
yeah.
I guess, nearly every day or every 2 days something is pumped out. There is really a stream of information. I'm just amazed how this is done. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but this was really something we were looking forward to since quite a while. And, well, as I said, I can recommend everybody to, well, either join a course or even become an instructor there. So I personally gained a lot from doing that. I hope I can be soon a real instructor by running a course, maybe organize one in Würzburg. This would be actually good. As I said, I did this before. I did a small Unix course, which is also online, but I might adapt this at some point. And, if there is anybody interested in this, please also write in our comments or write to Software Carpentry somewhere directly. And I'm pretty sure that this is a very good place to start also your teaching experience. As said, I gained a lot from that just by formalizing this. And I think I mentioned the book already, this How Learning Works, which was part of the, I wouldn't say curriculum there. This is a How Learning Works, 7 Research-Based Principles for Smart Teaching. And this is basically science-driven teaching, which I was not aware before, and I can really recommend that. Okay. Otherwise, I think we are more or less done. I guess we will run a normal episode at some point, although we have several people we would like to interview on the radar, but yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, next time normal episode is, I think, a very good idea.
Exactly. Okay, Matthias, then I would say have a good evening and talk to you soon.
Same to you. And thanks again, Greg, for being part of this episode.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Thank you very much. And bye, everybody.
Bye.